Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you again for joining us to the BDS SPME Monitor conference call. Glad to have everybody with us this afternoon for our last call of the year. Obviously, a very busy time of year, and there's a lot going on the issues that we deal with that we will discuss this afternoon. Our guest speaker this afternoon, as in the past, is Dr. Alex Jaffe, who is the editor of our BDS SPME Monitor. He will be addressing the recent issues of the day that will be further articulated in our forthcoming monthly BDS Monitor, which will be coming out at the end of the month. Let me just go over a few housekeeping issues as always. Should you have a question, and that we encourage as many questions as possible after Alex is done talking. Those of you who are logged in on the computer, you will see a icon of a hand. All you have to do is press that icon, and I will unmute you, and you'll be able to ask your questions. On the phone, you will just press the function of the question button, and again, I'll be able to unmute you even if you're logged in through the phone. There is also an email functionality should you want to send the question in while we're talking, and I can read your question. If you have questions after we're done with our call, our email is bdsmonitor@spme.org, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And without further ado, Alex, the floor is yours, and we will go from there.
Terrific. Thanks very much to everybody for joining us this morning. Let me offer my apologies in advance for the unpleasant nasal tone of my voice. I've been trying to get over a cold for the last few weeks. It's not going all that well. It's been a very consequential month in December so far for BDS, and I think and maybe I say this every month, but I think that there's some real and important changes that are occurring within the larger environment. On campus and off campus. And as Asaf said, I'll try and discuss this a little bit more fully in the monthly monitor at the end of this month. But let me hit a couple of important things, which I think have real consequences. For one thing, there's the affair of Mark Lamont Hill at Temple University. Hill is a faculty member there, and he appeared at the United Nations at the very end of November and made a series of statements that were dramatically hostile towards Israel, including expressing a wish that Palestine would be free from the river to the sea, or words to that effect. And there was a tremendous outcry against this, and also endorsing violence against Israelis in a rather indirect or backhanded fashion. Again, there was a big outcry about this, and CNN, for whom he had been a commentator for some time, dropped him as a commentator. And this produced a bit of a backlash, but more significantly, there was reaction from within and around Temple University. The head of the Board of Trustees stated publicly that he abhorred the Hill's comments, and he was examining whether Hill's comments rose to the level of something that he should be dismissed for. This caused, I think it's fair to say, a certain amount of hysteria among pro-BDS and other faculty members, and as is typical in many cases, lots of faculty members got together and wrote a letter saying this is the worst thing, this would be the worst thing ever. Remember that the trustees had only voiced the idea that they were going to look at the possibility of firing this tenured faculty member. And ultimately, the Board of Trustees said that, and I think probably quite correctly, that Hill's comments were covered under the First Amendment, but they abhorred his position. Now, this affair has to be set into a context. And I think this context is a growing conflict between faculty and administrations over what we would call free speech. The parameters of free speech, the nature of about the issue of university governance. Who's in charge here? So, again, sorry about my voice. Recall that last month, the faculty at Pitzer College, which is one of the five colleges outside of Los Angeles with Pomona and Harvey Mudd, voted to end their college's relationship with Haifa University for a semester abroad program over Israeli policy about prohibiting the entry of BDS supporters. And the university president, the college president of Pitzer, issued a very strong statement saying that this position was antithetical to the college's mission. And the BDS supporters on his faculty jumped up and down and rather ironically complained that they were being silenced or untenured faculty were being silenced by this statement. Recall also at the University of Michigan the month before in October, when two faculty members, one tenured, one untenured, refused to write letters of recommendation for students who wished to study in Israel. And when this became public and the university president and administration complained about this, faculty members, a large number of faculty members at the institution and nationally complained that this was a deep infringement on faculty members' free speech rights. So what is free speech and what is hate speech? What is free speech and what is professional responsibility? And ultimately, who is in charge here? Is it the faculty who have, what are faculty responsibilities here in the 21st century? Are they responsible to themselves? Are they responsible to students? Is there some sort of contractual series of obligations or reciprocal obligations? Does the university as an institution have some sort of responsibility, intellectual, fiduciary, or otherwise? Who's in charge here? And I think that this is one of the directions that the larger debate is going in. And pursuant to this, all 10 chancellors of the University of California campuses, Berkeley, UCLA, San Diego, and so on, issued a statement about 2 weeks ago, saying that BDS as a whole was, in effect, antithetical to the mission of the university system. So they're trying, I think, to forestall faculty rebellions, or at least lay down a marker for their faculties that these kinds of rebellions from within the faculty are unacceptable. So we're going to see who wins. The university, I think, has the ultimate hand or responsibility, but the extent to which universities can control faculties remains to be seen. And as I pointed out in previous calls and in previous BDS monitors, there is also a market element to the equation. The market, that is to say, students and alumni and parents and state legislators and others, respond to these kinds of changes, these kinds of incidents, and other similar kinds of incidents, by taking their money and their bodies elsewhere. We've seen this at Evergreen State, where protests last spring caused, among other things, a huge drop in enrollment. We saw this over the last 2 years at the University of Missouri, where there's a similar drop in enrollment, and also similar scrutiny and skepticism and anger from state legislators. So we'll see who's in charge, and we'll see where it goes. And we'll see what's acceptable in terms of free speech. whether one can call, whether a faculty member can call for the elimination of the state of Israel and as free speech, or whether this is hate speech, or whether hate speech goes in other directions only or primarily. And I might add here that there have been a few cases, and I'll point to one case which is sort of close to SPME's heart, and that's the case of Professor Andrew Pessin at Connecticut College, who made a comment, I think it was in 2014, on his Facebook page, where he called Hamas animals because of their aggressive, violent behavior against Israelis. And he was jumped on by students, and ultimately his job was threatened. It took a good deal of legal support for him to remain a tenured faculty member. So I think one could argue that the scales are not entirely balanced, and certainly in a proportional sense, a statistical sense, the scales are dramatically unbalanced, because the vocality of pro-BDS supporters on campus in the faculty and in the student body is dramatically higher than that of pro-Israel supporters, despite the small numbers. And there's the harassment and intimidation is obvious and palpable to anyone who has experienced it from the BDS side. And so we'll see where it goes. And, I think it's another sign that American universities are seriously sick institutions, or many of them are. And that I've argued repeatedly that only institutions that are sick, let's call it that, seriously entertain BDS as an alternative, and that only people who have an ideological commitment to BDS as a function of generalized opposition to America and to Israel, and as frank anti-Semitism of one form or another, these are the primary supporters. This is a kind of ideological religion that has spread throughout university society, particularly in the West. Now, I think we had use that as a segue. I think we have a very interesting kind of complementary example of how institutions can be taken over in real time, near real time, by anti-Semites and anti-Israel activists. And that is the example of the Women's March. And there was remarkable reporting in December, about 2 weeks ago, series of exposés which came out in Tablet magazine, which showed how the Women's March originated and was then in effect taken over covertly from within by its current leadership. Most notoriously, most famously, Linda Sarsour, and how they have manipulated the movement and its finances and aligned it explicitly and organizationally with Nation of Islam, which they continue to vocally support at every turn, as not coincidentally does Mark Lamont Hill. And the original leadership, the founding leadership who was pushed out 2 years ago and more, have documented the deep anti-Semitic orientation of the current leadership, who believe that Jews were responsible for the slave trade and that Israel is the source of all evil in the world, and so on. And I think that this is very much a parallel kind of case to what we have seen in the past with academic institutions like the American Studies Association and with the Modern Language Association, where successfully and unsuccessfully, respectively, these organizations were subject to hostile takeovers by anti-Semitic BDS supporters who were really interested in pushing one issue above all, and that is BDS and an opposition to Israel, and who engaged in financial and other shenanigans in order to bring it about. Now, in the case of the Women's March, the shenanigans appear to include paying themselves many times from multiple pockets and financially exploiting this institution, this organization called the Women's March. Whereas in the case of the American Studies Association, the shenanigans are more covert and focused on orienting the organization to become to boycott Israel and to isolate Jews who support Israel within the organization. Now, we could propose a parallel to this with the Democratic Socialists of America and their entree into the broader Democratic Party, with the what might be called a BDS caucus that has emerged within the party after the November elections, after the midterms, with Rashida Tlaib and her fellow travelers, who Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who seem to have a particular obsession with Israel and with promoting the isolation of Israel through BDS and otherwise. And it will be interesting to see, as the Democratic Socialists of America make continued inroads into the broader party, what will be done, or whether it will essentially be taken over in the manner of the American Studies Association and the Women's March. It remains to be seen. And knowledgeable observers and people of the left are becoming very concerned about these issues. So let me, there are lots of other things we could talk about. Let me just segue over to two other, well, let me make a direct segue from the Women's March and academia into the broadening of local boycotts against police exchanges with Israel, which expanded in December with the addition of the Vermont State Police, and I believe it's the Northampton, Massachusetts Police Department, which were supposed to have send members to Israel on an exchange organized by the ADL. The ADL, for some strange reason, has emerged as a particular nemesis of the Women's March, and is a particular nemesis of so-called Jewish BDS organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now. And so these two police forces in very left-leaning kinds of communities elected not to send a couple of their people over to Israel for training or consultations. And this echoes, this has echoed a theme that not simply has emerged from If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, but is a persistent theme of people like Mark Lamont Hill, that somehow Israel and Black Lives Matter movement, that somehow Israel is responsible, and Israeli training is responsible for American police violence against African Americans. Now, I think we can argue safely that police violence against African Americans predates not only exchange programs with Israel, but Israel itself. And but as is typical in these situations, I think it's sort of a kind of blood libel accusation that's very similar to sort of a modern updating of Jews were responsible for the slave trade kind of rhetoric, and it's gotten some traction. And predictably, unfortunately, as usual, Jews from the far left are leading the charge, and as a means to divide the American Jewish community against Israel. And this strategy, or this strategic goal, was also on display, and has been on display for several months, as these two organizations, If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, attempt to destroy Birthright from within. We recall the problems over the summer where If Not Now members sabotaged Birthright trips from within. They signed up for these trips, they went, and then they got up in the middle and said, these trips don't do justice to the Palestinians, and so on. Then we saw this in the fall as Jewish Voice for Peace and now J Street U promoted a series of petitions demanding that Palestinians be allowed on Birthright trips, because somehow this is their narrative is not being represented, so it's necessary for them, for Palestinian Americans or Palestinians in the Palestinian diaspora, so to speak, be funded to go on these trips as well, and it has nothing to do with, which now have nothing to do with Jewish identity, apparently. And we see this, so there's a strategy at work, a broad strategy. How coordinated the strategy is isn't clear to me, but as is very sadly frequently the case, Jews are at the forefront of trying to divide other Jews from Israel and from Jewish organizations, and with some success. There was a rumor that went around a week ago that Birthright enrollments were very much down. And this came out, of course, in the Forward and in Haaretz. And then when reporters followed up with Birthright officials, they found out that this is not the case. So this is an information operation. It's propaganda against Birthright, which was designed to discourage young people and young American Jews from signing up for the trips. So anything that works and is successful has to be destroyed. It seems to be the philosophy. And I think whether it's a broad institution like a university, a targeted institution like Birthright, we can count on the BDS movement and its I'll use the word Quisling. It's Jewish Quislings. Will attempt to destroy it and to alienate Jews and also other communities from Israel and from the broader Jewish community. And that is where we are, I think, as we go into 2019. So let me stop there and let's take some questions and have a discussion if we can.
Great. Thank you, Alex, as always, and appreciate the in-depth dealing with all the intricate issues that we are seeing evolving and ever changing all around in the landscape. So, but that being said, again, as Alex mentioned, the floor is now open, and we will take as many questions as individuals may have. If you have a question, all you have to do is click on the icon of the hand. I will be able to unmute you, and then you can ask your question. If you want to send in your question, you can do that via the system itself, and I can read your question, or you can email us. So the floor is now open to have that. While people are thinking about their questions, I guess I'll take the prerogative first, Alex, and I'll ask the first question. Going back to the this whole the latest events. Yesterday, of course, we saw a whole apropos misinformation and trying to give information and to control the narrative with Airbnb.
Right.
There was a lot of information that came out. First, it was they denounced it and they said they only met with the Israelis. The policy is still in place and they're still investigating. But one of the comments that was made in one of the reporting that they are now trying to figure out or seeking to understand the complexities of the conflict. And so they're trying to reach out to their stakeholders as a result of that. This is a greater concern, I think. Obviously, from the pop culture economic standpoint, people, the influence. Obviously, academia is the front line, but when you look at the impact of Airbnb and people like Roger Waters and others, how do you see all that evolving in connection to, of course, the elections, which is, apropos, your comment before. Rashida Tlaib is now planning her first mission to Israel, where she is planning to celebrate all of this. And do you see that this is going to lead to more an actual active BDS legislation coming from her and her supporters?
Well, let's break it apart a little bit. The Airbnb business is very confusing, and here I confess that I'm not exactly sure where we are as of today. I thought I had a grip on it yesterday, but I really don't know where we are at right this particular moment. But I think your point about control of the narrative is extremely important. That on the one hand, Israeli officials thought that they had convinced the company to give up this boycott of Jewish-owned properties, excuse me, in the occupied territories, so to speak. And the company, and then put out a statement about this, and then the company put out a statement saying, in Hebrew saying one thing and in English saying another thing. And then one of the vice presidents of the company went on a tour, and the Illinois Investment Board, or the Illinois governor and the governor of Florida, have threatened the company, saying that state level laws that have been adopted preventing the states from doing business with BDS are going to be invoked. So it's a very confusing situation and a very dynamic situation. The company Airbnb does business with a lot of countries that occupy a lot of other countries. And if you want to go rent an apartment in Turkish-occupied northern Cyprus, you can do that. So why is Israel being singled out?
Right.
And if the company adopts a broad policy, a uniform policy, where all territories that are suddenly that are somehow under dispute, then okay. Then at least it's uniform, and that will limit their business. But their singling out Israel is obviously problematic, and I think at the end of these last few days, it remains problematic. That the lack of clarity is precisely that. It's the lack of clarity about what their policy is and why they have singled out Israel. But as to the other issue regarding the BDS caucus, so to speak, in Congress, it does relate to legislative initiatives that are in Congress at the federal level and at the state level. And one thing I didn't talk about are emerging challenges all over the place in Arkansas, and especially in Texas now, to state level BDS laws would prevent the state from doing business, which prevent states from doing business with contractors who have adopted boycotts of Israel. And this has been misconstrued deliberately by BDS supporters, including the ACLU in Texas, as limitations on people's free speech rights. And it's not. has nothing to do with speech. It has to do with commercial behavior, that they simply can't discriminate against Israel, and they can have whatever opinions that they want. And if they want to discriminate against Israel, the state won't do business with them. The same way that the state won't do business with people who discriminate against African Americans or others. So these are being challenged now, and from what I can tell, there are better written versions of this law, and there are worse written versions of this law. And the Texas version seems to be pretty straightforward and unequivocal, and it's not clear that this challenge will stand up in court. But I think the broader issue is that there is now a caucus within the Congress that will promote a BDS narrative and an anti-Israel narrative, and that will claim Islamophobia as an excuse every time they say something anti-Semitic, or every time they say something anti-Semitic and it's pointed out, let's put it that way, and that will actively work to undermine the strategic relationship with Israel. And Flybe is a good example. She seemed, from what I can tell, she has really only one interest, and that's Israel, Palestine. She's already announced that she will be taking her oath of office dressed in traditional Palestinian garb, which is, you know, pure showboating, and that she will not be going on the traditional AIPAC trip to Israel with the incoming freshman class of the House, but she will rather be going on a separate trip organized by, I think it's Jewish Voice for Peace. Is that right, Asaf?
Yeah.
Which will focus on the occupation, so to speak.
Muted.
Be a presence to be dealt with, and how the leadership of the Congress as a whole and the Democratic Party as a whole will deal with this isn't clear. These characters are charismatic women in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s, I think. They are given absolute deference by mainstream media outlets who are oohing and aahing over their exoticism, which is a form of, I think, sort of racial indulgence or pandering, one might say, and it's reminiscent of the kind of pandering that ultimately got Barack Obama elected, moving him rather quickly from an obscure Illinois state senator and up the ladder. So one should never underestimate the ability of shallow people who are obsessed with one issue to be promoted because of their external characteristics. And I think it will change American politics going forward. And more broadly, the issue of them being, in effect, socialists, which is part of the great American tradition going back to the late 19th century. Right. Which went into abeyance after World War I, more or less, but which is now back, and which has a perpetual romance for far left, despite people eating dogs in Venezuela, and which has a relentless hostility towards Jews and towards Israel. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Indeed. Well, so we have several questions, and thank you for that. You know, for the deep explanation. So let me start by going, so we can, with the time that we have, going through them. So I will start reading, since they've all been sent to us. Let's read Stephen Kirschenblum's question. His first question is: The faculty and colleges are, of course, the future of deans and directors of the university, and he is looking for our input on the recent vote at NYU, where 30 student councils and faculty groups voted for BDS. That's Stephen's question. So do you want to take that, and then we'll move on to the next one?
Well, the NYU student government vote was a long time coming, and it was successful. And the administration immediately shot it down, and it put it into that statement put it into opposition not only with the students but with a block of faculty members. And there's really no place for this resolution itself to go. So I don't expect that the university is going to adopt this policy anytime soon. But it was, the university's statement was a little bit interesting in that what they said was, this goes against our values, and it would be really hard to do from an investment standpoint. And I thought that that was interesting because it was almost as if they took it seriously for a minute and sat down and think, well, how would we go about doing this? But I should mention in this context that NYU had another interesting event or incident more or less at the same time. 150 students did a sit-in at some administration building or a library or something. Over the issue of the university's food service contractor, a company called Aramark, which also does food service for prisons. So as part of an anti-mass incarceration protest, the students did a sit-in, and they sort of won. The university agreed to reconsider its contract and to try and transition itself to doing all of these food service tasks internally. And I can also point to a number of fossil fuel divestment resolutions which are under consideration by not only student governments calling on the university to divest from fossil fuel companies, but which are being considered by boards of trustees. And it's not clear that anybody's going to do that anytime soon, but all it takes is one. And I think that someday, sooner or later, some university will divest from fossil fuels, the same way that they will try and disconnect from companies that provide food to prisoners in the American penal system. And the same, and that sooner or later, I think it is entirely possible that a university or a college will say, "Yeah, we will try and do socially responsible investing and divest from Israel or from companies that are targeted by the BDS movement and which invest in Israel, do business with Israel." And the fact that the BDS movement and faculty members, excuse me, you know, students become faculty members become administrators, administrators and alumni sometimes even become trustees. And I think sooner or later it can happen, and it might happen. And it would pay for us to think about what would happen if that occurs.
Indeed. That's something you need to be concerned about. Our next question by Sonia, and so her question is, it is clear that African Americans are being used by BDS. The question is, what about the extreme white supremacists and the extreme right at large? How do they fit into this entire matrix?
Well, the Mark Lamont Hill incident was interesting because one of the people who praised Hill fulsomely for his statements about Israel was David Duke. So, right. You know, when you have David Duke, and as people pointed out, when you have David Duke praising you from one side and right. Louis Farrakhan praising you from the other, you know, you really should rethink about where you're at. on campus and off campus, the white supremacists, white nationalists, Christian identity types, all these folks are not present really within the BDS movement. And they're not significant forces on campus. And they're, in fact, they're completely repudiated, repeatedly repudiated on campus. And, you know, there's no, they have no official traction or sanction. And then anytime anybody finds a swastika carved into a bathroom stall, the university goes into lockdown. And whether that's right or wrong, whether that's an overreaction or appropriate reaction, is a separate question. But as I pointed out before, you can wear, you know, a Che Guevara shirt, or wave, you know, a flag of, I don't know, the Nation of Islam, right, who are equally, and that will be embraced not only as free speech but as progressive speech on campus. Now, it doesn't mean that white supremacists, white nationalists, and so on aren't a threat, and certainly after the calamity in Pittsburgh, we these things cannot be dismissed or minimized at all. But I think within the context of BDS and the campus, they're very much less significant. But we'll it'll be interesting to see now that, you know, Mark Lamont Hill has David Duke's you know, seal of approval. Maybe there will be more synergies, and I don't know. We'll find out. But it's less of a concern at the moment.
Yeah, and we're definitely seeing it on the right and on the left. They don't distinguish so much. I mean, you know, they find synergies there all around. So
right. They disagree on many issues.
Right. They'll agree.
They'll agree on these particular issues. But exactly. what that agreement means or what it brings isn't clear. So right.
Exactly. Great, thank you. So let's move on to Denise Tamir has a question. Her question is, believe that if that now has exposed the weakness of the Jewish community and how we educate our kids about Israel and the conflict, and should we be engaging and presenting the Palestinian narrative in the context before we engage with the other on campus, so to speak, and if so, examples of curriculum, more best practices, issues that you and I, Alex, have been involved in over the years, and to the extent of, I think, these are my words, you know, kind of the question of the Big Ten curriculum within the Jewish community, and, you know, how far, you know, what does one need to know in order to deal with the reality? That's Denise's question.
Well, as you said, these are issues that you and I have been deeply engaged with for a long time, and also at a different kind of professional level, being engaged with Israeli, Palestinian, and broader Arab, Middle Eastern issues. But I think it's a question, if the question is what's appropriate, the question should be, let me put it this way, what's appropriate in what context and at what age?
Right.
And then within the context of Jewish education, day schools, yeshivas, Sunday schools, and so on, what is appropriate for fifth graders, sixth graders, seventh graders, eighth graders is something very different from what's appropriate for 12th graders. And that because of the intrinsic nature of, let's say, an eighth grader and their level of knowledge, their level of maturity, their engagement with the world, and so on, it's some things are not appropriate. A 12th grader who's going off to college, and who hopefully has some direct experience of Israel through a trip, it's another level. What that content should look like is an interesting pedagogical problem. And I think that the answer to that is in part to let people speak for themselves. I mean, I'm a big as a historian, as an archaeologist, I'm a big supporter of using primary materials. And looking at Palestinian statements, Palestinian poetry, Palestinian newspapers, film, art, whatever. And that gives you some idea of what people are thinking. What we see, unfortunately, a good segue into the crisis in the Newton high school system, where our old friend Charles Jacobs and his organization has exposed a horrendous series of anti-Israel and basically anti-Semitic materials that are being used to educate the high schoolers, which are relentlessly hostile to Israel, you know, and which not only emphasize the occupation, but which, so to speak, but which are completely hostile and one-sided, let's put it that way. I am not a high school teacher, nor do I want to be a high school teacher, having been the parent of high schoolers and having once unfortunately gone through high school, I have a very low opinion of what goes on in most, but not all high schools. And I think we have to be very mindful. I mean, Asaf and I have worked on what goes on in Quaker schools for years, which are relentlessly hostile to Israel and which are relentlessly hostile to any sort of narrative or concept of fairness in which Israelis or Jews or supporters of Israel get any kind of fair hearing, much less balanced materials. So it's a real crisis, and parents and alums and students themselves, we don't find out about these things unless the students themselves speak out, or the parents pick up the book, whatever kind of horrible one-sided crap that their kids are being issued, and raise the alarm. So that's the first line of defense. And if we want to present the Palestinian narrative, that's great. I think that's very important, particularly when you get to college. But it certainly doesn't belong in the grade schools. It may or may not even belong in the high schools. And it relates to the way that we teach history as a whole in this country, which is superficial, which is one-sided, which is silly, and which is tendentious, mendacious, and so on. I'm not sure that's an answer, but...
No, all true. I mean, obviously, you and I have dealt with this over the years for a great deal of time, and I think to Denise's point about the question of if not now, the other part that ties into this silliness that we see all around is, of course, the perverse reality of how, especially when it comes to Jewish day schools, the Judaism is interpreted as pro-Palestinianism. So what you do find, of course, is a reality where all Jewish kids know about is the occupation and the Palestinian narrative without even knowing about their own Jewish history or Zionism for that matter. And this perverse reality where they try to define themselves by their pro-Palestinianism rather than their Jewishness. I mean, this is a growing phenomenon, and I agree, a growing crisis in the Jewish community at large. But, overall, you do see this, of course, within the public schools and elsewhere.
And we could talk here about, unfortunately, about the crisis of BDS within rabbinical seminaries.
Correct.
Which is a growing issue, which is largely under the radar, but which is beginning to come out. And Asaf and I have talked to a number of people who are involved in rabbinical training. And there have been a few reports which demonstrate that I won't even call it a narrative, but it's just hostility towards Israel being promoted as a kind of Jewish value by rabbis who are teaching other future rabbis. And it's a problem within the conservative movement, the reform movement, the reconstructionist movement within their specific seminaries. And it shapes what kind of Jews are going to be out there in the future. So the first challenge is to get Jewish institutions in shape, seminaries, day schools, and so on. And this doesn't mean eliminating the Palestinians or presenting some kind of propagandistic, one-sided narrative. It means, first of all, having some sort of fundamental baseline of Ahavat Yisrael, of, you know, love for other Jews and for Israel, which is very much, very much absent. And this is, I think, one of the great existential crises within the American Jewish community, on about which we could talk for another hour or more.
And growing. I mean, at your point, you know, the RRC, you know, which is the Reconstructionist Seminary here in my backyard in Philadelphia, is also the feeder to Hillel's. And so, of course, there's an echo chamber of what you see on campus with, you know, the rabbinical, with the rabbis and advocates of these issues. And of course, you know, well, as you've mentioned before, you know, our favorite topic in the world as far as Quaker education is growing. But you know, beyond the problems, you know, I think, you know, just to give Denise some ideas, I mean, you know, both Alex and I are historians, and I think that, you know, we, you know, just to reiterate Alex's point, I mean, curriculums that use primary materials on both ends are critical. And I think, you know, all of us who have taught these topics, Wikipedia is not a source. Libraries are a dying business, and we have to make sure that, you know, there is an incorporation of primary documents, you know, into the classroom, so students can see and hear what is going on and what was actually said, and from movies to culture to actually understand the folk, you know, culture and everything else that plays into both sides to understand that. There's not a magic bullet. There are several curriculums and trainings out there. I guess we can mention our friend and colleague Ken Stein at Emory, who has a pretty decent curriculum on the Arab-Israeli conflict that incorporates a lot of these issues. And that's not one curriculum to consider. So, I mean, there's a lot out there. There's a lot that needs to be done. But this is definitely a growing crisis in the community. Let's move on to the next question, given our time. Haley's question, actually, I think you already touched a little bit about this, Alex, was about the Texas issue. And there was an article with an op-ed by Glenn Greenwald and Jane Eisner on some of this stuff. Any more points on the Texas issue that you would like to raise at this point?
Well, it's about... the law has to do with commercial behavior. It doesn't have anything to do with speech. But supporters of BDS, either hard ones like Glenn Greenwald or softish, mushy ones like Jane Eisner or Jane Eisner's Forward, she's the editor of the Forward, persistently misrepresent it as a free speech issue. And these optics, this issue of controlling the narrative is extremely, extremely important. And we need to challenge these false narratives wherever possible. It speaks to the larger crisis in American journalism. Glenn Greenwald's not a journalist, really. He's a propagandist. And I think we need to, and all news outlets, all news platforms, things that call themselves news these days, have, excuse me, I'm sorry, have a particular narrative. They have a political orientation these days, whether we like it or not. It didn't start with Trump, didn't start with Obama. It goes back decades, and we're only really recognizing it now. That we have American journalism, print, so to say, what's left of print, with words, whether on screens or on paper, and certainly on television and radio, we have returned to the days of William Randolph Hearst and tendentious, one-sided journalism. And you can pick which side you want to read. But if you don't if you only read one source, you're going to be systematically misled, and you're going to let yourself be systematically misled. Whether it's the New York Times, whether it's the Daily Caller, Front Page Magazine, whether it's the Washington Post, and so on. Never, ever believe anything you read in print until you see it, until you check it out in a dozen more places. And because the narrative is what's in play. It's not the facts that are what are in play. It's control of the narrative. It's control of people's feelings. That's what's in play. And this has arguably been one of the great contributions, if we can call it that, of BDS and the Palestinian narrative to the broader global kind of news cycle and the broader pattern of information consumption that we've been conditioned by these issues by decades and decades and decades of Palestinians and their supporters waving the bloody shirt to react emotionally rather than factually. And our side always responds with facts. No, then the this didn't really happen here. No, there was no massacre. No, this is how people voted. People chose, da, 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 and so on. But the reality is that people's emotions are what are being played for. And this is the shape of journalism in the world. And until we get away from that, and until universities get away from indulging similar kinds of behaviors, inculcating these behaviors, we're going to be in a very bad situation, which is where we're at now.
Agreed. The picture is not pretty, and the challenges are only growing. our time is short, but I want to thank Alex, you as always, for the fascinating and, of course, in-depth conversation. And, of course, many of these issues will be articulated in greater depth in the forthcoming SPME BDS Monitor, which will be coming out before the end of the new year. I know there was some more questions, but, we are short on time, and I want to keep to our promised time to let people know to keep it to the allotted time. To that end, I really would like to take the opportunity to thank everybody for joining us this afternoon. Given that we are at the end of the year, I want to take the opportunity to wish everybody a happy holiday season and a happy new year. These issues are not going away. SPME was created to deal with this. We're trying to do what we can with what we have, and there's a lot that needs to be done. So obviously, we are hoping you will continue to join us in our next call, continue to support our work, continue to support everything we're doing, and obviously invite your friends and colleagues to join our network. Clearly, there is a great deal that we need to be tackling in the coming months, and we're here for that. So I want to thank everybody again. I want to thank Alex, and I want to wish everybody a happy and healthy new year, and we will talk again soon. So thank you very much, and have a good afternoon.
Thanks very much for joining us, then, and have a good new year and holiday.